How in the devil are you? I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to them. How in the devil are y'all? There's nothing mysterious about antimatter. There's nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle are identical in almost every respect, except they're opposite. For example, an anti-electron has a positive charge, whereas an ordinary electron carries a negative charge. By always creating particles and antiparticles in equal numbers, nature ensures that electric charge is not magically produced out of nothingness. Some of you sound like you arrived here drunk. If you'd try, you'd understand this. As long as particles and antiparticles spontaneously appear and disappear in pairs, nature's electric charge balance sheet is always satisfied. See, God's got a big bookkeeper up there in heaven. And he sits there all day balancing the antis. And the real. Now, the number drives a bookkeeper crazy, like somebody making an entry on one side of double entry bookkeeping and not putting it on the other side. Now, when the books don't balance, that's hell. Who said science isn't entertaining? I read that from Black Holes and Warped Space-Time. Good title. I'm telling you, a black hole would warp your space-time, all right. William J. Kaufman. This is heavy stuff. Now, as I was saying, there's nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle are identical in almost every respect, except that they carry opposite electric charges. That's what marriage has been about for years. See, people run around trying to cross the circuits that are messing things up. Now, some of you think that I don't know what I'm going to talk about tonight. I know exactly what I'm going to talk about. I'm tired of reading all this funny stuff. This strange stuff, this far-out stuff. I said I'd bring a scientific book tonight. Black Holes and Warp Space-Time. Bob Hope would pay you guys. I haven't said my funniest parts yet. I'm tired of reading this weird stuff. Somebody's going to think I've flipped. If I decide I'd be scientific tonight. There's nothing mysterious about antimatter. You know what antimatter is? It ain't matter. Now, I didn't say it don't matter. I said it ain't matter. Not only that, it can't matter either. And matter can't antimatter. Antimatter's antimatter, and matter's matter. But there's nothing mysterious about it. Nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle. Now, I'm telling you, some antiparticles will get you. Like the preacher got in a fight with that bully, and the bully said, "You better run." He says, "Well, you better worry about the three fellows that are with me." You know that story, don't you? God and Christ and the Holy Ghost. And the bully says, "I don't see him." And the preacher says, "Them's the one who'll get you." Now, things wrong with this world. Too many of you been living not being aware of antimatter. You think all that matters is matter. But there's antimatter. And there's nothing mysterious about antimatter. It says it right there. This science book. There is nothing mysterious about antimatter. Can't you find that? There's nothing mysterious about antimatter. That's what it said. What he said. That means we're saying the same thing. You better go out and get yourself a fur coat tonight, or you might turn into antimatter. I decided we'd keep it cool enough for Sammy tonight. I prepared. There is nothing mysterious about antimatter. I've been watching it get warm in here, and you going to sleep every night. I'm going to make it so cold tonight that if you go to sleep, your snot will freeze, and when you snore, you'll pierce your brain with an icicle. Craig says, "That's cold." There is nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle are identical in almost every respect, except that they carry opposite electric charges. For example, an anti-electron has a positive charge, whereas an ordinary electron carries a negative charge. That's what it said. By always creating particles and antiparticles in equal numbers, nature ensures that electric charge is not magically produced out of nothingness. What do you expect? This is the university network. Always have some of these traditional saints call me every night and say, "Can you save me?" No. They're like the fellow that got in Lorne Fox's healing line up in Oroville. He was there every night for 6 nights. My dad says, "Haven't I seen you here before?" He says, "Yeah." "Well, are you getting healed?" "No," he says, "but the treatments are feeling good." Lorne would touch him, and he'd fall, and old Cecil would catch him and set him down gently. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
As long as particles and antiparticles spontaneously appear or disappear in pairs, who would want to disappear any other way? Nature's electric charge balance sheet is always satisfied. The problem we got over there on the national lines is two antimatters are sitting side by side. Two of them. We'd get a positive particle between them, we might get something worthwhile. The time intervals over which this process occurs are incredibly brief. For example, during an interval of 1 billion trillionth of a second, that is what I said. Very simple, folks. If you had any mathematical knowledge and any mathematical ability, you could put it up there instantly and know exactly what it is. 10^23. That's how fast it occurs. Yet it's incredibly simple. Nothing mysterious about antimatter, it's just fast. That's what I said. The time intervals over which this process occurs are incredibly brief. For example, during an interval of 1 billion trillionth. Just multiply that out. 10 × 10 × 10 × 10 × 10^23, that's what you get. Do it right now. This is a university network. During an interval of 1 billion trillionth of a second, an electron and an anti-electron can spontaneously appear and disappear. And this can occur absolutely anywhere. It can also occur with more massive particles. Craig and Sam. But because of the reciprocal nature of the uncertainty principle, these more massive particles can exist only for correspondingly shorter time intervals. You guys are getting your psychoanalysis free tonight. For example, the proton is 2,000 times as heavy as the electron. Now take one good look, folks, and figure it out for yourself. Therefore, put up Take Me to the Water. Therefore, pairs of protons and antiprotons can appear and disappear provided they last for only 1/2,000th as long as the pairs of electrons and anti-electrons. That's why I have more of the rest of us here. Got it figured out? Now, one of the functional doctrines of subatomic physics, usually attributed to Murray Gell-Mann of Caltech, is if it's not strictly forbidden, then it must occur. I'm telling you, you can say these scientists are dry if you want to, but I'm exposing the real truth. I believe I'll read that again. From Caltech, no less. If it's not strictly forbidden, then it must occur. It refers to any quantum process. That's what they are. Therefore, you following this now? Therefore, pairs of every conceivable particle and antiparticle are constantly being created and destroyed everywhere. The Lord's working slow on the second half of that part, the destroying part. The question is, will they destroy us before themselves be thusly committed? Therefore, pairs of every conceivable particle and antiparticle are constantly being created and destroyed everywhere, at every location, all across the universe. Now, I want my time buyer to send this particular tape to all stations who want a sample tape of what the University Network does. Therefore, Pairs of every conceivable particle and antiparticle are constantly being created and destroyed everywhere, at every location, all across the universe. Of course, we have no way of directly observing these pairs of particles and antiparticles, except the shaman. That is forbidden by the uncertainty principle. The particle-antiparticle pairs simply exist for such short time intervals that direct observation is impossible, and for this reason they're called virtual pairs. They don't really exist. They virtually exist. Not virtuously. Virtually. There's a difference. I'm very sure that Craig and Sam virtually exist. I will not vouch for the other part. In fact, I don't even want to know about the other part. Considering they're massive particles, I doubt I'd find it interesting. Would you? Though virtual pairs of particles and antiparticles cannot be directly observed, present company being the exception, their effects have been detected. I'd like to tell all you folks on the national line that Craig sent his clothes out for laundry yesterday, if you haven't figured it out already for yourself. Their effects have been detected. Imagine. Am I boring you? Now, I want you to know that a true-false test in this will not... Although virtual pairs of particles and antiparticles cannot be directly observed, their effects have been detected. Imagine. An electron in orbit around or about the nucleus of an atom, such as a hydrogen atom. Ideally, the electron should follow its orbit in a smooth, unhampered fashion. That's me. But because of constant brief appearance and disappearance of pairs of particles and antiparticles, that's them. Tiny electric fields exist for extremely short intervals of time. Sparks. When I ever get worked up or mad, they're the reasons. Them antiparticles and particles over there. These tiny, fleeting electric fields cause the electron to jiggle slightly in its orbit. That's me. This jiggling was first detected in 1947. I was born in 1929. I've been all shook up. This jiggling was first detected in 1947 by W.E. Lamb and R.C. Rutherford, who noticed a tiny shift in the spectrum of light from the hydrogen atom. This phenomenon is known as the Lamb shift. You got it? The Lamb shift. It provides powerful support for the idea that it's too hot in here. Sparks are flying. It provides powerful support for the idea that every point in space all across the universe is seething with virtual pairs of particles and antiparticles. Am I boring you? This gets heavy. The concept of virtual pairs also provides a ready explanation for the phenomenon of pair production. For many years, it has been known that highly energetic gamma rays can convert their energy into pairs of particles and antiparticles according to the equation E equals MC2. Square. What I said. You don't even have to get out of grammar school to figure out that two means squared. Been a while, but I've been to grammar school. quite simply, the gamma ray disappears upon colliding with a second photon, and in its place a particle and antiparticle appear. This process is commonly observed in high-energy nuclear experiments. Indeed, it's one way in which nuclear physics can manufacture many exotic species of particles and antiparticles. Where do these particles and antiparticles come from? Lord, I wish I knew. Every time Craig arrives, he's from a different place. Where do these particles and antiparticles come from? They spring from nature's ample supply of virtual pairs. You mean there's more like them? The gamma ray provides a virtual pair with so much energy that the virtual particles can materialize and appear as real particles in the real world. Now, you want me to go further? You may have thought I was trying to do a comedy routine. Here's scientific definition of materialization in the unseen world, but it's a matter of relativity. We just don't know how to do it yet. We know how to dematerialize to the degree we can change the makeup of reality and get a great explosion and split the atoms and endanger ourselves to the point that it's possible to blow the world up. It won't happen because God will see to it. But where does the supernatural and the natural begin and end? Maybe that's relative, and the real difference is source and quality. And visible and invisible, rather than mystical and normal. And I'm going to tell you, that's truer to the biblical frame than the super spiritual religious people are. What turned me off on religion was the tendency to make spirituality weird. Heaven's out there. But out there includes black holes. What's a black hole? Here's attempts to diagram one. Now, the gravitational effect of light makes what you see not true. See, the shaman state of consciousness sees what we see as not true and what he sees as true. And by the way, I still need help from my audience because we have tried all day. We've called the National Geographic. We've called the stations that were given to us last night, and we're still unable to locate that movie that many of you have seen on television of the shaman who converted his subjects into, I remember one, a boar. A wild boar who ate poisonous roots somewhere in Southeast Asia. And I really need help from people that saw it, have contacts. I want to find that film, its source. We called the National Geographic Society, and the clerk we reached said it wasn't in their files. So if any of you know, please help us again tonight. But a black hole is so strong in its gravitation that if you are looking through space to a star, get the picture here. If you're looking through space to a star, the light rays are so bent by the gravitational pull that the real path of the light goes down. See it curve down? Let me get a pencil and then I can make it flow for you. Now, let's talk about a black hole for a minute. White dwarfs, if you take the Earth and compress it down to a marble, it might become a white dwarf, though it might take more than that. You'd so compress the mass that though small in size, the gravitational pull would increase with the compression of that mass until if you were to step on it, you'd become a pancake. Keep carrying it further, there is a point of inversion where analogous to, but not the same as, you pass from matter to antimatter. You pierce that barrier and it becomes nothing from the side of the universe as we know it. We don't know what's on the other side. And matter has either dematerialized to nothing, and yet it had within itself the pull of gravity from the compression as a white dwarf. Just keep compressing it. And yet, you can't see it because light doesn't escape from a black hole. But you can find its position in space because a star's light passing by a black hole bends down. See, it isn't in the hole, but even nearby, it passes and bends down in the gravitational suction, climbs out on the other side, and hits our eye. We're looking, and we think the star is there. Straight line, shortest distance between two points. We see the star is there. It really is here. Now, what's appearance and what's reality? Now, this is a gravitational curvature of space trying to give a little impression of the beginning of what becomes a black hole. Let me give you another picture. The embedding gravitational pull increases as the gravity heats up. Eventually, maybe I can find a picture here somewhere, the black hole becomes a bridge. And some theorists have said in one section of space it goes in, comes out on another section of space. Others view it theoretically like this. The truth is they don't know where it goes. And some spiritualist theorists have said a black hole becomes the entrance to heaven. You move into a realm, again, not antimatter, but analogous to the opposite. Take the theory of antimatter, particles and antiparticles, matter and antimatter. And for all the universes we know it, the opposite, unseen, is there to balance on a grand scale. Now, we're discussing the extraterrestrial, the preternatural, to borrow another phrase, the supernatural, which can't be translated literally, the more natural, the unseen, the invisible. Didn't Paul say, we look not on the things which are seen, but on the things which are unseen? Things which are seen are temporal. Things which are unseen are eternal. Wasn't the church built in a spiritual experience where a reality not seen literally infilled the believers and gave them an infusion of life and power that brought the church into existence and began to fulfill the harvest festival's meaning, which was a shadow of things to come? Passage after passage that I've been referring to the last few days, the servant of the prophet in the Old Testament that has his eyes open and sees the hosts of the Lord encamped, Jesus' statement, legions of angels he could call on when he told Peter to put his sword away, And where did Jesus go when he said, touch me not, I haven't yet ascended to the Father? And where did he go when he ascended? And in the high priestly prayer, he said, among other things, he was going to come back and get us and take us to that place. And what is the rapture of the church, which literally means catching away? Now, my purpose in teaching is to prove that the grand old book is not as stupid as some men have made it. And that the God who created all of this did not get his foot in his mouth, but a pea-brained world that thought they had compressed reality and put it in their little materialistic box are now being forced to encounter reality extra to themselves, larger than themselves, outside themselves, and inside themselves. And I happen to be dealing with the darker side, the evil side, demonology. Now, many people have asked me, have you got a copy of the book, The Beautiful Side of Evil? Yes. It raises the question, are all healings from God? And I can tell you going out the gate, no. And the title is immediately intriguing, The Beautiful Side of Evil. Now, last night I was on shamanism. For some of you, you'll have to wait the rerun to get it. I brought another book tonight on the shaman, The Wounded Healer by Joan Halifax. Shaman. Now, Joan Halifax is no kook. Joan Halifax, PhD, medical anthropologist and director of the Ojai Foundation, has worked with healers and shamans the world over. Some of you will remember that I said, if miracles are going to turn you on, you're a setup for Antichrist. And I attended a Shinto sect meeting in Japan and watched with my two eyes as the Shinto sect leader laid hands on a fever-racked sick person on a cot. And that person instantly got up well. Don't need somebody to tell me about that. And I used to discuss this with Dr. Kishimoto when I was in individual study with him at Stanford University, who was guest professor for 5 years in this country from the University of Tokyo. Though Buddhism and mountain worship in Japan, two different kinds of religion, were his specialties, he also was expert in the Shinto sects in Japan. Miracles are not unique to Christianity and to God and to God's servants. And if you want to take the text out of context, nobody can perform these miracles except to be from God. You're going to get yourself in a black hole, my friend, that ain't the other side of heaven. Now, I'm sure I've been scaring a few people. Hope I've been waking some people up. I got 9 years of solid teaching, and I'd like my teaching to be set in that solid context as I deal with this subject. I'm still the same teacher teaching the same truth, that God's Word will stand the test of the modern scientific community. If you don't want to follow God as a matter of choice, that's your business. But I'm sick and tired of a generation being turned off from God because they think you have to park your head and brains at the door to become a Christian. You don't have to cease to be a Christian because it will not stand up on even peer level with any philosophy in the modern world. Joan Halifax, alongside research at Columbia and Miami universities, the Musée de l'Homme in Paris and the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, where she was concerned with those dying of cancer. She has assisted Joseph Campbell on his historical atlas of world mythology a Harvard faculty member. She's co-author of The Human Encounter with Death and author of Shamanic Voices. What I'm dealing with is not just the property of the Nutty Fringe. That's the point I'm making. My search for the ghost of Flight 401. I said 411. It's 401. Any of you ever heard of the ghost of Flight 401? A plane that crashed down in Florida, in the Everglades, and a certain flight engineer, Don Repo, I think's his name. I'll check it in here later. Yeah, Repo. Hung around. Some flight engineer on another L-1011 was down in the galley, which you know on the L-1011s is down an elevator and lower. And suddenly, a flight engineer, namely Don Repo, who had been killed in the crash, materialized and says, "Don't worry about the pre-flight check, I've already done it." I never did find out whether that engineer that went down there to check needed an elevator to get back up to the main floor or not. I'm going to have mercy on you. Help me out, somebody. Get that thing over there. Help me. Help me. Help me now. Now listen. Too cold in here. Turn the heat up. Don't ever say I didn't do anything for you. I never did find out whether that flight attendant used the elevator to get back up to the main deck or not. Wouldn't surprise me any if they caught him somewhere over the Rockies. Then this same flight engineer or attendant or whatever he was, Don Repo, materialized on a plane or on a pre-flight checkup or something, told him, "Watch out, there'd be a fire in engine 3 or something like that." And there was. And they had to land with less than a complete flotilla of engines. I had an Eastern stewardess, I think it was, the other night, call and say, "Please talk on this subject. We're not allowed to. We'll get fired if we do." It's been rumored with consistency throughout the airline industry for several years since the crash. And after a couple of people who believe in these things, two separate ones, by the way, a couple in one case, another one, did a soul freeing. Now, to those who use this language, exorcism casts out evil spirits. Soul freeing sets a departed spirit or soul of one, I'm using their terms, who has died free from its either confusion or hangover attachment to this life. I can tell you, too, that you'll have to set their souls free when they go, and that's Sammy and Craig. Set it free to go and accept the fact that it's heading for a new world. Now, if I hadn't been teaching so seriously for several weeks, I'd already be turned off by some people. The gestalt I'm seeking, the feel on the subject matter is that there is a world of empirical evidence. Evidence is not proof. But you can't prove anything. You can't prove you exist. You build up evidence until a psychological existential happening occurs, like a jury that looks at evidence. And the question asked earlier is relevant. You either become sure one way, positively, or sure the other way, negatively, or you remain agnostic. But you will never know what your existential reaction will be until you're exposed to the evidence. Still too cold in here. Turn everything off. I'm getting a chill. I mean, you know, my soulmate's in here from the equator genetic stream are putting a hex on me, and I'm chilling. Is anybody laying on the floor there that passed out in the darkness? I know there were more people here when we started. I mean, it took a whole week for some of them to figure out that they could sneak out when I turned out the lights. I want a list of those that were here when we started. Because when I'm teaching on this subject and people dematerialize, look over there, you can shoot a cannon in that front row, and you better have a good aim or you couldn't hit a voice of faith. I think before we start the marathon of the weekend, if these little short sessions we've had this week have killed them off that fast, before we start the marathon of the weekend, I need some new voice of faith volunteers. That's what I said. Some of you toughens from Kentucky and Texas need to fly in here to give us a little help on the phones. Sheila, think of that. Now, as I was saying, what was I saying? If I hadn't been teaching all these weeks so seriously, I'd already be canceled out tonight on this subject. But there's a gestalt I've wanted to come through. I read from Beowulf, the historic myth of the Scandinavian peoples. The classic fight between the denizens of the underworld, Grendel and his crowd, in that state because in that myth they'd kill Cain. Well, the Bible has a terrible punishment for those that kill Cain. I read from the Judaic Encyclopedia the demonology and the realization that the King James doesn't help us too much in the study of demonology. They call things devils that are specific, proper names of heathen gods. And they call things screech owls and wild beasts, and disconsolate ones, which are proper names of demons in a hierarchy of demons. There's little doubt about what Jesus encountered demons from the demoniac of the Gadarenes to one that was in a synagogue. There can be no question, as the Antichrist symbol, if it is a symbol, I believe it's a real person. But if you're a neo-Orthodox theologian, you'll treat it as a myth of the end time, which simply says that sin, whatever its form, will get worse, and the last expression of sin in history is the worst expression of sin. And the neo-Orthodox people who finally came to understand that sin was real did recognize the answer came from beyond history. And the last expression of sin, the worst kind. I'm literal in that sense. I believe Antichrist, a real person, real ruler, possessed of a demon. But there can be no doubt that there's not only an intensification of sin toward the end, there's an intensification of demon work. Demons released out of the bottomless pit in the book of Revelations are now helicopter. And pilots and guns shooting off of them. They're demons, scorpion demons, led by a ruler demon called Abaddon. 200 million demons have been chained unseen, caged, if you will, in the area around the Euphrates River to be released during the tribulation. Now, the Bible's been laughed at for postulating this other realm, extra terrestrial UFOs, my Lord, extraterrestrial visits to this planet. That's going on in the Bible. Elijah takes off. No wonder Elisha says, my father, the chariot of the Lord and the horsemen thereof. You say, well, that's a vision. Tell Elijah, he's gone. I mean, it was one powerful dematerialization. You say, well, he just was nothing. Well, he showed up again on the Mount of Transfiguration. Right there with Moses. And the book of Jude says, Lucifer and Michael, the archangel, fought over the body of Moses. And Lucifer lost. You suppose the fight was very important because Moses had in his afterlife destiny to show up on that Mount of Transfiguration to encourage Christ? Or let's take a very prestigious evangelical Bible teacher, J. Sidlow Baxter, who does not conclude but offers solid evidence that Moses and Elijah just might be the last two witnesses in the book of Revelation, where two witnesses come, work miracles, nobody can touch them, then they're slain, the world looks at them laying in the streets, and then they're raptured, translated, called away. Extraterrestrial visitors, two witnesses, and then they go back. Now, the argument has been, it's pointed out the man wants to die. Therefore, everybody has to die. Therefore, Enoch didn't die. Therefore, Enoch has to be one of those witnesses because he didn't die. Well, go ahead. Make Enoch your choice. Doesn't matter to me. It's two. Jay said, but Baxter's argument is they are witnesses. What do they bear witness to the world in the last day? Well, Moses and Elijah were witness of his transfiguration. Their name there. We don't know who the witnesses of the resurrection were, the two shining ones. We don't know who the witnesses of the ascension were, who said, why stand you gazing up into heaven? Chances are, same one. Now, rather than Satan fighting for the body of Moses, because he had some advanced knowledge that Moses would be there to encourage Jesus at a critical time, maybe Satan knew. You know, house cleaning is never a big problem to me. You know, I'm sitting here trying to spin around on my chair and I'm slipping and sliding with this paper. I got to get some grip. I didn't mean to do that. You can take care of that for me, Peter. Listen close. Maybe what Satan knew was much more important. That in the plan of God all along, Moses and Elijah were going to be those last two witnesses. Enoch will get plenty of credit. He built the monument that will stand in the center of Egypt and at the border thereof. He laid down the plan of the world and prophecy in the pyramid that will enable God to say, I told you so, as stated in Isaiah 19. Did God plan for Moses and Elijah to be those last two witnesses? If he did, then you can understand the training he put them through. Because God's whole... Do you realize, after the centuries of dealing and fighting with Satan to bring forth the veracity of his word and to bring forth a people that he can show off before the denizens of eternity? Everything stands on two witnesses. What if one of them breaks under the pressure? What if Satan can get to two of them, or one of them? Now you understand why Moses and Elijah received some of the toughest training. And they had practice in working the miracles that will be worked by those two witnesses. Now, God got the jump on the devil. He zipped old Elijah up in his chariot, and there wasn't any fight over his body. But when Moses died, Jude says, Satan and Michael fought over the body of Moses. Michael had to win it. And Michael dare not curse Satan. He was that powerful. And that's why there is absolutely no question but what the Book of Revelation passage where Michael is released to cast Satan out. The Book of Job and the wrestling over the body of Moses proves that's yet to be a future event. Because he has not yet been cast out. And Michael wasn't free to cursing, just to possess the body of Moses. Because Satan knew. If he had got Moses' body, God's plan for those last two witnesses would have been interfered with, if they're the two. And they're the most likely candidates. But the point to what I'm doing now is you can't read the Bible without encountering these things. What are you going to do with them? And then what did the demoniac of the Gadarenes have? Gas pains? You say, that's rather gross. Not half as gross as what possessed him. Now, I'm trying to show that there's empirical evidence, once again, to verify the Bible's position. I've seen people from little limited perspectives say, because the Bible reports miracle or reports these supernatural dimensions, it ought to be written off out of hand. Hey, I started to read in an earlier hour a continuation of the study of the shaman. Joan Halifax, shaman. Joan Halifax, PhD, medical anthropologist and director of the Ojai Foundation. Research at Columbia and Miami University. A Harvard faculty member. This is not a subject just for nuts. For the shaman, all that exists in the revealed world has living force within it. This life energy force, like the Polynesian Mana or the Sioux Indian Wakanda, is conceived of as a divine force which permeates all. If you study matter and antimatter, you're going to find there's energy. And to the shaman, energy, life, and power are synonymous. Many of the great religions of the Far East have that same concept. The shaman personalizes all phenomena. I suppose in that sense, a form of pantheism. But it's personalized life in all phenomena. Again, I say, you study the phenomena of matter and antimatter. And virtual reality, as the scientists call it. Shaman may have hold of something. The shaman personalized all phenomena in the universe, endowing them with human qualities. The tree trembles beneath the axe. The drum wails under the baton. All things have emotions which are subject to influence. Have you ever heard of people that talk to flowers? They'll swear you treat a flower right, it'll grow better. And you stop the average Westerner, you see the smirk instantly when you say that. We just have developed in recent years the ability to photograph the aura. The naturalism so oversimplified life, it was in danger of making it diminutive and destroying its outreach. Now, I'm interested primarily in showing that modern science and psychical research will confirm the Bible and once again prove it right. You don't have to abandon your faith for intellectual reasons. The Bible was more right all along than the scientist who taught me in university. That's the major point. But now, I've been reading in The Demonologist by Gerald Brittle, Ed and Lorraine Warren, hoping to make the point that the Catholics at least know who the enemy is. I've been reading The Devil in Connecticut, The Strange Case of Demon Possession of David Glatzel. Turn the lights down. Those more can sneak out. I'm going to get scary now. I need to tell you the viewpoint that the Warrens have, and many who deal with this phenomenon. They believe that there are spirits out there. That's very biblical, good and bad. And we're caught between. But most of Christianity camps out on one of two extremes. Soul sleeping, when you die, it's just vast black nothingness, white nothingness, or nothingness until the day of the resurrection. And the others, it's an instant express trip to the presence of Christ. And I'm telling you, if you have faith, if you understand what Paul says, death is the beginning. Paul says, the time of my departure is at hand, and every time I preach a funeral as a pastor, there will never be an exception. I will use that text somewhere in the message where Paul says, the time of my departure is at hand. The word in the Greek is very unique, very specific, exclusively used to characterize a ship laden for the journey, just leaving the harbor, just getting started. It is the semantical trick of morticians and cemeteries talk about death as rest. Paul talked of death as beginning the trip. Everything was preparation. The time of my departure is the same as you've prepared for a trip. And now you walk across the boardwalk and you get on the ship just starting your trip. And if you have faith and understanding, that's what death ought to be. But those who engage in this kind of research have piled up a mountain, and there's an entire society in Britain that has monitored and researched tens of thousands of cases. And there are too many people entirely ignorant of the research that just write it off. It's like parapsychology. For years, extrasensory perception was considered to be trickery. Until major universities in America began to research it and the threshold was crossed. It is no longer an issue whether it happens. The question is how, what, and by what means. Research has mounted over the last few years. I think as God is preparing the day of the end until more and more nobody will have excuse for afterlife evidenced experience. And those who research it postulate an in-between happening on occasions. A sudden death, a surprise death, an accident, an unprepared for death. a happening where the person is not is unlike Paul, ready for his departure and eagerly anticipates it, but even though he could say as Paul did, better for me, absent from the body, to be present with the Lord, but he has a job to do. But when the time of the departure has come, it's just getting started for him. These researchers postulate the happening of some departed souls or spirits who haven't quite got it all together. Caught by surprise, a sudden accidental death or something. This is their research, their conclusions. Spirit's still a little bit confused, or the soul, they interchange the words. And it can't quite turn loose yet and move on. Now, some serious questions are raised by this. If you introduce the doctrines of hell, because if you are dying and going the wrong way, who in hell would want to turn loose? A big gap in the research is that most of these people are talking of those who die going the right place, heading for the light. They don't really say it that way. They're just a light, and they go to it, and somewhere beyond they find their destiny. But in between, now this is a brand new addition to what I've been doing. And if I hadn't shown you for several days, I'm not any nut. I'm just laying it all out on the table till we can begin to gestalt the simple conclusion. There's an awful lot of stuff out there that needs to be considered. Now we're talking about ghosts. Somebody asked me, did you plan this the Halloween time? No, I didn't. It just all of a sudden happened. I've had these books around, most of them, for years. Some of them know that all of you are helping me and sending me things. But some deaths, they postulate, the soul or spirit, the essential self or whatever name they give it, doesn't want to leave for whatever reason and hangs around, or doesn't know it's supposed to leave, hangs around. In short, it sort of marches into eternity backwards, still looking back. And unlike Lot's wife, there's no salt pillars in between. So they hang around till they get a message across. Remember the ghost at West Point that Ed and Lorraine dealt with? When he could finally get across, they could get across to him, go now to the light. Everybody knows you weren't guilty. Now, in the ghost of Flight 401, you're dealing with that kind of phenomenon. A sudden accidental death, and Don Repo not yet ready to go. Still hanging around. Up till now, with the little bypass on the ghost at West Point, we've concentrated on angelic versus demonic forces, correct? And I'm well aware. I come out of a historic church stream. So I'm well aware of the repercussions and the disraveling when we start talking about that other phenomenon, those departed spirits still around. Well, I've never heard of such a thing. Well, these people, and a lot of people, have encounters with them that they perceive to be the presence capable of manifesting to the point of recognition of one who's dead, and yet his self or herself can materialize in part or whole and be perceived and communicate with the living. That's what they call ghosts versus inhuman spirits. Well, I never heard of such a thing. You ever hear of Samuel and the witch at Endor? And Saul? In the Old Testament, Saul went to the witch of Endor. And she brought up a manifestation that Saul perceived as Samuel, and the manifested one, or the manifestation per se, went along with the idea. Now, what really happened? What really happened? Did Samuel manifest? Did he come forth? Or was there some spirit being out there who played the role? And if so, why? Now, either there's only here and now and no hereafter, and no out there and no other. Or there is here and now and there and other. Now, Paul says, we look not on the things which are seen, but on the things which are unseen. Things which are seen are temporal, things which are unseen are eternal. Well, you can poeticize it, but I think the context drives you to the conclusion Paul meant it to be literal. Right? Now, what happened to my book? Well, it dematerialized for a minute. Now, listen to me. Or if it is accepted, there is a there and other as well as a here and now. Then you can assume that there and other is all good or all bad, or degrees of both. The historic Hebraic Christian position is there is a there and another, and they're at war. And the good's going to win ultimately, but there's a struggle going on, and we are the prize. In Christianity, is not a mode of self-pottery making, whereby we are forever shaping ourselves in an imitation of God. It is a warfare in which we become the vessel or instrument by which the powers of God prevail against the powers of evil, and we wrestle not against flesh and blood. That's basic Christianity. Is there evidence of such conflict? Now we're introducing another dimension, a sphere in between, departed souls, not yet realized in fullness, but very much alive, but in a different state of being. These researchers postulate some of those in an in-between, sometimes confused, sometimes malignant in attitude, in-between area, where they still have contact with the here and now, haven't accepted that they now belong to the there and other, and they ought to get on with the trip. They're still swimming around in the harbor. That's what these people postulate. But an alternative is that in the there and other, the evil demonic forces may have the capacity to imitate. Now, was that materialization Samuel? Or was an evil force by this witch of Endor impersonating Samuel? Your a priori theological position will determine the conclusion. There is no way the text can prove either one. But in either case, you're dealing with the there and other. If you assume it really was Samuel, then he was somewhere in between available to that witch. And you better believe, I have great respect for Samuel, but I sure don't want to be available to a witch when I'm gone. I mean, I'm going to build a rocket on my tail and shoot on out of here. You understand what I'm saying? Now, this book I do not recommend. I won't buy it and put it in my bookstore. It could have been a great book. I'm sorry. It is written as a sequel. The girl was a Northwest Orient Airline stewardess. Became a research assistant to a journalist. They became partners in the study and lovers. They began to intensely research the evidence for the ghost of Flight 401. She discovered in a seance that she had embryonic psychic powers and began to develop those powers. John, throughout most of the research, was a hard-nosed, look-for-evidence journalist. The book could have been a great one, but she fills it full of so much personal, from some of her gripes about the routinizing of the stewardess pattern on Northwest Orient Airlines, to all the little side trips to restaurants. I suppose to some it makes a nice story, but for a researcher on this subject, you have to wade through too much non-essential to get the essential. So take it from me, if you want to read it, you can. It's very honest on the cover. It says a ghost story, a love story, a true story. And there's too much of the love story, and not enough of the rest of it for my purposes. If you want the love story, you can have at it. I don't like to waste time when I'm researching. But it's got some amazing stuff in it. Some of it. Oftentimes, Repo appeared to deliver a warning that something harmful was going to happen to the L-1011. And crew members would see him. And she, too, could not, the journalist couldn't get anything out of these people. Where'd my handkerchief go? There it is. But being a person of the trade, even though a crew member of another airline, she was able to talk at length. And in the book, which may weaken the credulity in the minds of some, she was forced to use, by agreement, artificial names for the Eastern Airlines crew members that she interviewed because they're not allowed to talk about it. For fear they would be forced to go to the company's drink and be fired. In this brief, he became quite an expert on psychical research. And she summarizes some of the interesting little items in the research. Let me read you one. And by the way, she finally brings the hard-nosed journalist around and a large section of the book from about that much to the end of it. They finally begin to communicate with Don Repo on a Ouija board. They carry on lengthy conversations. Finding out things through the Ouija board, no way they could have known. Even old John becomes converted at that point. And he writes the book, The Ghost of Flight 401. She then does the sequel with John doing an epilogue, My Search for the Ghost of Flight 401. I want to read you something. You ready? Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Search for the Ghost of Flight 401. Is this a Bannon book or what? Nonfiction. Liz Fuller. Who's the publisher? Berkeley Medallion Books. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the noted neuropsychiatrist, had spent 25 years of her practice studying dying patients. According to a story published in Newsweek and several newspapers, several years after she decided to drop that sort of study, a woman entered her office. What's going on back there? Shut that door. According to a story published in Newsweek and several newspapers, several years after she decided to drop that sort of study, a woman entered her office. Dr. Kubler-Ross immediately recognized the woman as a patient who had died 6 months earlier. The woman sat down across from Dr. Kubler-Ross's desk and told her that she was disappointed in the doctor's decision to give up studying dying patients. Dr. Kubler-Ross's thoughts flashed back to all the times she had counseled patients who had reported seeing such apparitions. She conducted a quick reality test, asking the woman to write down her name and address. The patient did so, and then walked right out of the door. Startled, Dr. Kubler-Ross verified the slip of paper against other documents signed with the former patient. The signatures were identical. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is now, incidentally, lecturing all over the world on her convictions of the reality of life after death. This girl, and I will say this, you know, she's not the world's best writer. She mixes a lot of extraneous stuff. But she really got into studying, and her research is amazing. But she says, and it's interesting to watch her own growth from total skeptic, more turned on by John, the researcher, whom she met on a trip, than the subject itself. But as she gets into the subject, it's amazing to watch her transformation as she's exposed to facts. Now, the Bible and Christianity ought to remove the fear of death. That's probably the greatest fear that Satan holds over mankind. And Jesus took that key from him, if Christianity is correct. And you can quickly sort out how much faith people have when death's on the horizon. If I had known about Dr. Kubler-Ross's studies before this course that she was in, I probably would have been more open to what Patricia was talking about, and she was in a particular class at the time. I was also to discover that another psychiatrist had a paranormal experience. Hey, I keep asking my people to share with me their experiences. The ones that trust me and trust my ability to hold confidence. But I'm not reading, I hope you notice, that I'm not reading from the nutty fringe as the intellectual world would consider it. Another psychiatrist had a paranormal experience. In fact, Dr. George Ritchie's own account of life after death had inspired Dr. Raymond A. Moody to write his bestseller, Life After Life. Dr. Moody even dedicated the book to him. In 1943, when Dr. Ritchie was in the service, now, I'm really sorry that the folks in Dallas did not hear the full trip of the shaman last night and the archaeologist, and you'll hear it on a rerun, but his experience into realms of life and the shaman's trips into the underworld. Because you need to see the connections and the common denominators. In 1943, when Dr. Ritchie was in the service, he was selected to go to the University of Virginia Medical School. How about my dad? Some of you have heard him tell his experience. Out of the body, in the coma with rheumatic fever in 1936. But let me tell this. In 1943, when Dr. Ritchie was in the service, he was selected to go to the University of Virginia Medical School. He said that at that time in his life, he felt that if he had had, he felt as if he had the world by the tail. By the time he reached the age of 25, he was sure he would have a home on the beach and a Cadillac in his garage. Now, I want to tell you, when you study shamans, by either discipline or in many cases a severe sickness, they withdraw, so to speak, from the normal world and are put in a position where they entertain, concentrate on, and encounter this other dimension of life. And when you're so wrapped up in the things of this world, it doesn't really interest you, the subject. Either by voluntary choice and discipline and suffering, or through sickness, involuntarily, many times, that becomes the catalyst that drives them over the hill, so to speak, to encounter this vast dimension of life most of us never encounter. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons why the gift of healing in the most fundamental circles usually operates with most effectiveness through someone that has faced death and come back from that chaotic threshold through healing themselves. Let's go on. By the time he reached the age of 25, he was sure he would have a home on the beach and a Cadillac in his garage. However, 5 days before he was to enter medical school, he landed in the hospital with an upper respiratory infection. By 3 a.m., he felt terrible. He asked the ward boy what his temperature was and discovered it was 106. The ward boy ran for the doctor. A chest x-ray was immediately ordered for Ritchie. Ritchie said the last thing he could remember was the x-ray. Later he found out that he had been pronounced dead. There was no pulse, no blood pressure. He had died from double lobar pneumonia. The ward boy was ordered to prepare him for the morgue. 10 minutes after he had been declared dead, another doctor came in and confirmed it. Somehow the ward boy insisted that they try giving him a shot of adrenaline. This was considered highly dangerous because it could create a living vegetable, but the heart started almost immediately. Recalling his terrifying experience, Ritchie told later what happened during the time he, quote, died. I sat up on the side of my bed. You've heard my dad tell the story. He saw himself laying in the bed and felt himself as though carried in the arms of someone. When he approached heaven, he saw his mother waving him home. Then the scene changed, and other scenes changed. When he said, by the way, I'm ready to go, Lord, but I hate to leave my wife and boy. And then the series of scenes came. There are others that can tell stories like that. I sat up. Now, the doctors are pronouncing him dead. Here's Richie's side of it. I sat up on the side of my bed, upset that I would miss my train back to Richmond. What I wasn't prepared for was looking back and seeing myself lying there. Do you realize how wonderful it would be if people could be exposed to enough evidence to really know? I mean, live it to the fullest. Make faith work to the maximum. But if you could really know with the certainty those New Testament Christians had until they had to be sometimes kept from seeking a martyr's grave, that this life is but preparation for another, and death is the doorway, the departure point, as Paul put it, Well, let's just read on. This is a kind. I wasn't prepared for looking back and seeing myself lying there. I felt myself rise from the foot of the bed and walk across the corridor. I saw a ward boy rolling the stretcher down it, the corridor that is, and I walked right through the stretcher and out the hospital door. I seemed to travel at the speed of sound. I was determined to get to Richmond. I found myself lying on the street next to an illuminated cafe. Soldiers passed me. I tried to speak, but they walked right through me. He went on to report that he had left his body back on the bed. Suddenly he realized that if a ward boy or the man on the street hadn't seen him and passed right through him, something was wrong. He simply had to go back and pick up his body. But he couldn't remember what room he was in. The hospital had over 3,000 beds. Dr. Ritchie continues his description. It was a real identity crisis, physical identity crisis. After what seemed like hours, I found my body. But the sheet was pulled over my head. It seemed like hours to him. But the sheet was pulled over my head. I could tell because my hand was sticking out and my fraternity ring with a chipped stone was still on my hand. I noticed that my hand was very blue. I was horrified. I then sat on the bed and tried to pull the sheet off my body. But I failed. The situation hit Dr. Ritchie like a ton of bricks. He knew that it must be death. Is this one going further and too far? I don't know if I should continue on this subject. Now, in the Ghost of Flight 401, a Christian couple who believe, and another of psychical research events, heard so much about Don Repo continuing to appear on 1011s, particularly one plane, that they dedicated themselves to a soul-freeing session to let him know, hey, man, go toward the light and go on to the next life. And after they performed that soul-freeing effort, there weren't any more reports of it.